Two related questions. The first one is, for an unemployed person today, there's certain societal costs, whether it's unemployment insurance, food stamps, healthcare expenditures. If the government creates a job by hiring someone to do infrastructure type spending, what do you think, do you have an estimate of what the marginal savings would be on and the cost that would go away by that person having a job? And then this second question.
I'm pretty sure I don't have an answer to the first one, so let's go to the second one.
All right, second question is, in reviewing all this, the policy accommodation you talked about, which is, you know, low rates for two more years, and huge ballooning of the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, this has never been done before. This policy accommodation is historic, and the movement in the unemployment rate is relatively small. It's still at an unacceptably high level. And the question is, at what point do you say, listen, while we can still do more, in the bigger picture, we've fired a lot of bullets here, we've stopped it from getting worse, it's getting a little bit better. At what point do you say there needs to be something on the fiscal side? And I know this opens up huge Pandora's box of you know, polarized politics going on, but at what point does the Federal Reserve say, listen, here's some policy options, our economists have looked at it, we think it would have this impact. At what point would the Federal Reserve want to do that, or would they never under any circumstance want to go down that road?
So I will take the second question, and I take pretty literally the disclaimer I made at the beginning of my speech, was I speak for myself and I don't try to speak for the Federal Reserve System. So with that caveat, I'll try to answer your second question, which is, I'd be pretty averse to our giving advice to Congress about what kind of fiscal policies they should adopt. You know, we're fairly sensitive about members of Congress offering advice about how we should make monetary policy. And there are overseers. I think that I would feel pretty averse to taking that path of laying out fiscal policy options and actually trying to make a choice among them. I think that choice is a very challenging one in the current environment. It's up to the voters, up to the members of Congress, up to the president to make those judgments. In terms of the first question, I mean, I think the social losses associated with unemployment would also have to include the idea that there's this lost output associated with that unemployed person not having a job. One way, the different models will give different solutions for that. So I'm not going to, in terms of trying to weigh off these social losses. I will make a comment about infrastructure, which is that. If I think about running the government as a business, and I think about infrastructure as being an investment opportunity, so like a project that the government could do, real interest rates are very low right now. So a lot of projects that might have not seemed as attractive from the point of view of benefits, long-term benefits versus short-term costs in 2005, say, given that real interest rates are so low right now for the government to borrow at, forgetting about multipliers, et cetera, just in terms of running the government as a business, projects that may not have been as attractive just from an NPV point of view in 2005, net present value point of view, might look like they're in the money now. But beyond that, I don't really have much to say about fiscal policy, I guess.
Eric?
That side. Also, two questions, just about the link between income and output in your policy decisions. Given the volatility, but also the higher impact of food and energy prices, do you also look at inflation under older definitions, which would have included food and energy, or do you only look at it excluding that? And then the second question is sort of a similar potential disconnect. How do you incorporate changes in things like the velocity of money as you get more accommodating? The measures which sort of resist getting the intended effect on money supply.
Okay, so let me talk about the first question first, which is about the use of core inflation in these metrics. As I try to indicate in my speech, I I view our mandate as being about headline inflation. So our goal is to keep headline inflation at 2% or a bit under. Now, with that said, monetary policy doesn't operate by our turning a switch and then, boy, inflation goes up or goes down next month. It's really about looking over a 3 to 4 year horizon. So when you're looking for measures of inflationary pressures or underlying inflation, you really want to have something that's going to help you forecast what's going to go down the pike 3 to 4 years out. I think this year was a great example of the dangers of using using measures of inflation to include energy prices in that. Headline inflation looked, year over year headline inflation rose to pretty high levels in the early part of this year in particular, because energy prices had gone up by 20%. I didn't expect energy prices to keep going up by 20% every year for the next 3 to 4 years, so I wouldn't want to build that into my forecast. With that said, if you look at the summary of economic projections that the committee offers, it will include a headline metric in there as well. So you could form a dashboard with headline measures. I don't think qualitatively it would make. I think most of the time, qualitatively you wouldn't make different judgments about what to do. I forgot what you're saying. Oh, about the money supply. Ah, so this is a very important point. So the question was. We've had a huge increase in the monetary base, and yet relatively little movement in inflation. And that seems, from the point of view of traditional theories of monetary economics, that seems pretty surprising. There's this thing called the quantity theory of money, whereby if you increase the monetary base, increase the amount of reserves that banks are holding, increase money, you should get a big increase. Impetus on prices. That connection, which I learned and I spent 20 years trying to teach other people about, is gone. And it's gone permanently because of the ability of the Federal Reserve to pay interest on reserves. So this was an ability that on interest on bank reserves in particular. What that means is that when conditions improve and banks have lending opportunities, what you would have, if the Fed could not pay interest on reserves, what would have happened then is that the banks would essentially be lending out those reserves and creating, that would take the money out of the hands of the banks and put it in the general economy, putting upward pressure on prices. That's when the Fed could not pay interest on reserves. Now that the Fed can pay interest on reserves, what it will be doing, it can raise the interest rate it's paying on those reserves and deter those banks from spilling those reserves into the general economy. So there's no longer going to be a linkage necessarily. There's no necessary linkage between the size of the balance sheet and inflationary pressures. This is critical for us to be able to communicate more effectively than I just did. And because I think it's at the heart of a lot of misunderstanding of policy. Oh, John, you're in charge.
George Shultz.
Is there in your deliberations any sense of any limit at all to the amount of money that can flow out of the discount window and over any period of time, therefore, what amounts to gifts to the banks? I'm referring, of course, to this Bloomberg story that I'm sure you've seen, showing that in December 2008, before you were on the board, the amount of money in the discount window was over $1 trillion. And they calculate the gift to the banks was on the order of $15 billion. Seems like a lot. Is there any sense of any limit at all to what the Fed could do?
So, as you said yourself, this was before I was on the Federal Open Market Committee. I will say that I think that it's important to keep in mind. I'm not going to answer your question because I don't have a number in my head that I can just offer to you off the top of my head. And it's not really when I talk about monetary policy, it literally was about monetary policy. So that not about the lending interventions that were emphasized in the Bloomberg article. My predecessor, Gary Stern, who was the president of Minneapolis, was interviewed with that article, and he said he didn't know about it. It's because it doesn't get discussed in the context of the of the committee deliberations. With that said, and so I'm not trying to backpedal from those decisions, I think those decisions were critical ones. They were critical because the Fed has an obligation to fulfill a dual mandate. And the dual mandate is promote price stability, promote max employment. I do not think that it would have been operating in fulfillment of those that dual mandate from Congress if it had not made those lending interventions. Now, why do I say that? We don't know for sure what would have happened if the Fed had just stood back on the sidelines and did nothing. We have no way to know that for sure. But we do have the observation from the Great Depression, the 29-32 period, and where the Fed did do nothing, and the outcome was not good. In particular, in the price stability, even if you're just concerned about price stability, you know, you don't care about the employment side of the mandate, which is not true for me and not true for my colleagues, but even if you're just a price stability person, the outcome in the Great Depression was that we had deflation rates of over 20%. That is, prices were falling at 20% per year. So I think these kinds of interventions were very valuable ones. And I think it's important, every monetary policy action we take, for example, keeping interest rates low, it helps borrowers more than it helps savers. There's always a distributional component to these kinds of interventions. What we're about is trying to achieve the mandates that have been assigned to us by the Congress of the United States.
Is able to do. If it's a judgment, it's going to help.
I was offering, a defense of the particular actions that were taken in that time frame.
Here. We can get a mic here.
Given the nature of the global nature of crisis nowadays, through a trade channel, through the financial channel or psychological channel. Can you explain how FOMC work with the other central bank to deal with global crisis?
So that's a good question about how we work with other central banks. You know, it depends on the, this is, I'm gonna say this is a little, the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis president is not involved in these discussions, so it's not on my level. But having said that, you know, you can definitely point to important coordination across central banks that took place during the financial crisis of 2007 to 2009. In particular, I think the introduction of central bank swaps during that time period was very important. The reopening of those lines in May of 2010, I think, was a valuable step as well. But I'm sure there are other kinds of informal discussions going on. It's above my pay grade.
Just going to call on John Taylor.
I like the idea of a contingency plan. Or
I thought it might appeal to you.
problem is, though, it doesn't say anything about what you do with your instruments. It's you said nothing about whether how much the interest rate should change or whether you should do $2 trillion or $10 trillion of quantitative easing. It's completely unaccountable as a strategy. You have to put some numbers or description of what you do with the instruments to make this useful for people.
I think it's a totally fair comment, John. I think that I would, at this stage, I was trying to describe it qualitatively, but to get serious about it, you would have to be quantitative. I agree with that absolutely. I think that one example of a contingency plan is certainly the Taylor rule. I mean, that's definitely one example of something that would fit into the general class of objects I would describe. I think I wanted to be more general than that, more flexible than that. But to be serious about it, yeah, you have to fill in numbers here. That would be. It's not. I don't think it's my job per se to do that. It's more the committee's job operating together to try to fill in those numbers. But that's absolutely correct.
Yes. Here comes the mic.
Hi. Yeah. Well, maybe linking into that question. I mean, on the one hand, yes, one can interpret your presentation saying we'd love to have a Taylor rule. But on the other hand, if you look at the changing trade-offs that have happened in recent years. My concern is that if one throws out these concepts, that the way that cynics will interpret that is that, well, how about we tell the market where we would like to be and therefore we get away with higher inflation than we would otherwise, because we'll tell them we'll do the right thing down the road. And I think that links a little bit into John Taylor's question, because unless you set the specific target, people say, well, all this thing is just a smokescreen. And how do you address that? Of course, you said, hey, you got to be accountable and really act. But how do you know that ahead of time? How do you not make the communication strategy into just a manipulation of expectation strategy?
This is a great question. I mean, I think that I've talked about, so there's, what I view my speech as being about, at times the questions I get and the focus I get is really on tactics. What's going to happen to interest rates? Those are the kinds of questions. I've tried to flesh it out to be more about strategy. What you're describing is, what are your objectives? And how can we make sure, how can we check on you? How can we validate that you're actually pursuing those objectives? I think that's a good question that I think inflation targeting regimes and flexible inflation targeting regimes have to grapple with. I think it's especially challenging when one of your main instruments, the federal funds rate, is constrained at the zero lower bound, because at that time I think that different kinds of considerations come into play in a lot of models, I should say, a lot of economic models. Different kinds of considerations, different ways of weighting the two mandates start to manifest themselves because of the constraints you face on one of those rules. We have to find ways to be able to talk about that and articulate that. This speech doesn't do that, but we do have to have ways to do that. I agree.
David.
So has the FOMC considered or looked at any alternative measures of inflation, which many folks think may more accurately measure what is going on in the real economy?
So you have to be more specific for me.
Well, you know, there are measures that I know you're excluding energy and food and a lot of other items that most Americans are affecting their budgets. So there are alternative measures that, just like there are alternative measures to unemployment, which might be much higher. So I'm just saying that, do you consider those and do you look at them at all?
Yeah, certainly the dialogue on the table focuses on a variety of measures of what we think of as underlying inflation. What we mean by underlying inflation is our attempt to forecast and project what is inflation going to be, what's affecting inflation, what's the path of inflation going to look like over the next 3 to 4 years, because that's sort of the frequency we've got to be thinking about in terms of monetary policy. We can't be just thinking about the next moment in time, the next month. But we have a variety of measures we end up looking like. The Cleveland Fed produces what's called the median consumer price index, which it looks at a wide variety of goods and then ranks them in terms of how much their prices have increased over the past month, and then looks at the middle one. The one is 50% of the goods have risen more than that, 50% of the goods have risen less than that. So that's one, and then they actually have a number of different kinds of measures that don't explicitly get rid of food and energy, but then are also still trying to get at this idea that you don't want everything to be driven by the fact that energy prices have gone up by 20% over a year's time, because you don't expect energy prices to keep doing that. You've got to get rid of that factor somehow. If you look at the behavior of the median consumer price index and the Cleveland Fed's measures, or the Dallas Fed also has a similar approach using the PCE. These are also, they tend to match up with what's going on with core, not with what's going on with headline. But I want to be clear. I view our mandate as being about the behavior of headline inflation. And I think we've done well on that particular mandate. So if you go back to December 2007, that was well before I joined the committee, but go back to the beginning of the recession, December 2007, over that nearly four-year period, what's inflation averaged? 1.8%. And that's including all the goods. That's PCE. You look at CPI, it's averaged 1.9%. That's 2% or a bit under. So I honestly think that the focus on what people perceive to be inflationary behavior of the Fed is really tied to the fact that the balance sheet has gotten as big as it has, and not about the numbers of actually what's happened to the prices of goods and services in the economy. And there is why I think this dialogue that I tried to explain why that doesn't matter anymore, I think that's really critical for us to get on
top. Let me have one last question. Now, I realize there's an excess supply of questions, but that's what happens when you don't use the price system.
Okay. Narayan, I was going to ask about the risks of global inflation feeding back into the U.S. And the story I'm thinking about is one where some of the liquidity that's been created by the Fed and by the ECB, et cetera, some of that goes abroad through the carry trade, the fact that interest rates are lower here than other countries. That pushes up prices in other countries, in emerging countries, and that feeds back through some global money supply or something like that. But it feeds back into global prices, and that comes in through the balance of payments. Do you have any thoughts on that problem?
Yeah, this is our baseline model. The Fed tries to capture those kinds of effects. How well it does, you know, is the different question on that. But certainly it's something we think about, something we're concerned about, and affects our deliberations. But it ends up being the way, at least the modeling we have, it doesn't end up being something that's marked in any way.
Narayana, thank you very much, and thanks to the audience.